You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In for Leonard Lopate, our government is sleepwalking its way to an unfunded spending spree of catastrophic proportion. That is what we berated European countries for doing while we've let the same thing happen at home. But while Congress has been spilling red ink to cover its checks, David Wessel has been spilling black ink to cover the story. The prolific Wall Street Journal columnist is also a two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning best-selling author of In Fed We Trust. His new book, Red Ink, goes inside the high-stakes politics of the federal budget to explain how we got to the foot of this fiscal cliff. The book hit stores yesterday. David Wessel, thanks for joining us here on The Leonard Lopate Show.
Good to be here.
If Congress does not act, we could hit this fiscal cliff that people are talking about in January when the Bush tax cuts and these other massive spending cuts are set to take effect. Remind us when and why this deadline was put in place.
Sure. You know, one of the things I haven't figured out yet, so is a fiscal cliff something you run into or something you go over and fall into the abyss?
Right.
Basically, what
neither one of those sound very good.
Not good. Not good. Last year, Congress decided in order to force it to come to terms with the deficit, it would take a gun and point it at the American economy, set the trigger to go off December 31st, 2012, unless Congress and the president came to some compromise and found an alternative way to reduce the deficit. The gun is set to be triggered at the end of the year. It will mean tax increases on almost everybody and pretty severe across-the-board spending cuts, particularly hard on the Defense Department, which is why you hear a lot of yelping from defense contractors. The sad thing is that Congress seems to be unable to live up to what it promised, and instead of undoing the trigger, they're inclined to take the bullets out and put this off for another day.
Was this a good idea set this?
No, it was a terrible idea.
Any other way around it at the time?
Well, it was important to get Congress to vote to raise the limit on federal borrowing, which is that is to say that to give the U.S. Treasury permission to pay the national credit card bill. If we hadn't done that, we would really be in worse shape. I think the problem here is that Congress keeps coming up with all these fancy formulas and triggers and ceilings, and they hope that that will force them to compromise and take action. But in my experience in covering the budget in Washington, first, you have to have a resolve to do something. You decide to do something, and then you put these rules on to kind of make sure you stick to your own promises. This business of coming up with formulae and rules and budget triggers has not worked, and this is the ultimate proof.
This cliff that we keep talking about, in a way, is sort of automatic austerity. Would that be so bad?
Yes, it would be bad. We have a pretty weak economy now. It's growing at a painfully slow rate. We have unemployment at 8.2%. We'll get some more numbers on Friday. Maybe it'll come down. The economy is not strong enough to take a wallop of tax increases and spending cuts. Those people who favor going over the fiscal cliff or running into it are basically saying only if we create a crisis like the one they have in Europe will the politicians be forced to do something. But I think that's pretty dangerous given how weak our economy is, particularly because if people think Congress is really unable to govern, that's just going to undermine confidence and lead to an even worse economy than we would have had otherwise.
Some of those you're talking about include Senator Patty Murray of Washington and other senior Democrats say they're prepared to weather a fiscal crisis at the end of the year unless Republicans drop their opposition to higher taxes. Do you think they're bluffing?
I think it's a bargaining position. And I think this is a game of chicken in which each side isn't sure how far the other one can go. And I think that's pretty dangerous because, as we saw last summer when we had this flap over the debt ceiling, even though they raised the debt ceiling ultimately, it caused so much consternation that it had a tangible effect on the economy. So when you're driving the car so close to the cliff and you say to yourself, don't worry, we'll hit the brakes just before we really go over it, that's a very dangerous game, I think.
This cliff we're talking about is at the end of the year, yet our fiscal year will end a little more than a month before the election on September 30th. Where do we stand on the books today?
Right. Well, the Republican and Democratic leadership of Congress have decided in the last few days that shutting the government down on October 1st would be risky to all politicians. let's face it, the only institution in America that seems to be held in worse repute than the press is the U.S. Congress. And so they've agreed to extend the operating of the federal budget through March. So the government won't shut down in October. We won't have that ridiculous parade of headlines. But they gave themselves 6 months.
And your take on this, it seems to me that this agreement came pretty fast and came easily, and frankly, because I guess they just didn't want to have it out in public and risk their credibility on both sides. Is that
right.
fair?
Because if I'm doing something and I think it'll help me and hurt you, I keep doing it. But if both of us think that whatever we're doing is going to hurt both of us, then it's relatively easy to come to agreement. Congress managed to agree to cut taxes on everybody, last December. And it's clear that Congress thought that the politicians thought that it would not be good for them to have another showdown over a shutdown of the federal government.
In your last book, In Fed We Trust, a New York Times bestseller, you discussed the expanding powers of the Federal Reserve in the face of the economic crisis. The Fed may act very soon, maybe even today. What's the latest?
Right. Well, at 2:15 this afternoon, we'll know what the Fed is going to do. And I've learned that when you make predictions, don't make them 2 or 3 hours before the event because it's just embarrassing. But clearly what's going on is the Federal Reserve had hoped that the economy would be stronger now than it is. They're worried about the fact that unemployment is high, and if the economy doesn't pick up steam soon, could go higher rather than lower. They're worried about Europe. And they're worried about all the uncertainty that Congress and the president have created with this fiscal cliff craziness. And they see it as their responsibility to act preemptively. So clearly on the table are a number of things at the Fed which involve various ways of easing credit in the economy to make it a little better to borrow and to try and get things going a little faster.
I'm Elliot Forrest in for Leonard Lopate today. David Wessel is with us. His new book is called Red Ink, Inside the High-Stakes Politics of the Federal Budget. Talk just a little bit more about the Fed. Can they actually put us on the path towards recovery, or is this just a fiscal issue now?
The Fed is not exactly out of ammo, but they're running short on it. So they can make things a little bit better. And Ben Bernanke and his colleagues at the Fed think that what they've done so far has been a plus. So I think what they can do is prevent things from getting much worse. But you're right. Fundamentally, what we have here is a slow-growing economy. It's not all because of fiscal issues, but fiscal issues are creating uncertainty. That's a problem. And fiscal policy could help here. I mean, Ben Bernanke has called for what I like to call two-fisted fiscal policy. The economy might need some help now, but it would be a lot better if that help was accompanied by a reasonable plan to bring down the deficit over the next decade. That seems to be the common sense thing to do, but getting approval for common sense things in Washington now seems impossible.
It's probably a bad idea, but do you think Congress would be able to call tough shots if it had the Fed's independence?
No, and that's why the Congress, although it takes shots at the Fed, never really passes a law to tamper with their independence. Basically, most members of Congress, and that's always a dangerous thing to say these days because you never know what most of them think, but most members of Congress think we completely screwed up tax and spending policy. Don't give us monetary policy interest rates or we'll screw that up too.
Talk to us about what this enormous federal budget is actually being spent on right now.
Well, one of the things that's, I think, most arresting is that when Congress shows up every year, 63% of the spending is already committed. It's been promised in the form of Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, veterans pensions, farm subsidies, and interest on the federal debt. So much of what they do, the discussion we had earlier about shutting down the government, is argue about the remaining third. That two-thirds is kind of on autopilot. They address it from time to time, but they're not forced to do it. In many ways, you could describe the federal government very simply. It's a big military that's running a health and retirement company on the side. Everything else is a relatively small share of federal spending.
Let's talk about that, the defense budget. You write in your book that the U.S. spends more in defense than the next highest spending 17 other defense budgets combined. You want to rattle off those countries?
Yeah, right. So we spend about $700 billion a year on the military now. That's more than the combined military budgets in order of China, Britain, France, Russia, Japan, Saudi Arabia, Germany, India, Italy, Brazil, South Korea, Australia, Canada, Turkey, the United Arab Emirates, Spain, and Israel. We spend more than all of them combined. And that probably cannot go on much longer. It's interesting in the campaign that Mitt Romney is calling for an increase in defense spending. And I was fascinated to see that President Obama is running ads against that, which leads me to believe that Obama's pollsters and focus groups people sense that we may be at the point where the public doesn't want to keep spending quite as much on defense.
It just seems to me we're not having a realistic discussion about military spending. It seems like we're trying to fight one war and fund another. I mean, with drones taking more of an active role, we're still building aircraft carriers. Am I wrong here?
I don't think you're wrong. The reason I hesitate is it's hard for me to find any part of the budget where I can say we're having an honest debate. One of the problems with the military is that it's an old cliche that they're always fighting the last war. And you mentioned aircraft carriers. There are some people in the military who think that aircraft carriers are no longer a smart thing for us to have more of because they're sitting ducks out there in the water. You can launch a lot of airplanes for them, and you can get to places that you don't have bases. But with all the missiles and stuff, they may be sitting ducks. Each aircraft carrier costs $11 billion, and Congress has forced the Navy to have 11 of them. They want to replace each of them with a new one every 5 years.
And what's the cost just to replace them?
Right. Well, that's a great point. I was shocked to discover that aircraft carriers are expensive even in death. It takes $2 billion to decommission an aircraft carrier because they have to do something with the two nuclear reactors that are on board.
And in your opinion, how much of the military budget is actually defending the nation and how much is keeping constituents and politicians happy in areas that get defense dollars and jobs?
Well, I think there's some of each. Look, I don't think that we are in a world where we can afford to have no defense budget. I do think that the threats are new and changing. I mean, for instance, the capacity. Someone asked me the other day, aren't I worried about the Chinese shooting our satellites out of the sky? And I said, I'm more worried about some Chinese hacker in some secret base in China finding a way to interfere with the computers that communicate with that satellite. So there are things we have to do. But you're absolutely right that whenever you touch any part of the defense budget, you discover it's in some congressman's district or some senator's state, and they object. It's why one of the few things that Congress actually managed to pull off was they set up this base closing commission, and they said, you tell us which bases to close, and we'll vote the thing up or down. And they managed to close some bases that way. Some people think that's the only way we're going to fix the deficit. Someone puts together a plan, and Congress has to say yes or no, and you can't pick it apart.
I still, to this day, have the warnings in my ear of Eisenhower of the military-industrial complex, and I'm just not hearing that kind of conversation.
No, you're right. Although, I think you'd be surprised. If you listen to some of the conservative Republicans in Washington who are in favor of smaller government, many of them are critical of the defense budget. It's not only a left-right thing anymore.
Right. Because you're about interventionism and more isolation.
Some of it is interventionism, and some of it is if you really are a government needs to spend less, it's hard to overlook the defense budget. Some of them manage to do it. The honest ones don't.
We still spend, what, $2.3 trillion on mandatory programs, other ones other than the military, like Social Security, health care, food stamps. Do Americans realize the cost of these programs?
I don't think so. You know, if there are any heroes in my book, one of them is Doug Elmendorf, who's a kind of brainy, nerdy economist who runs the Congressional Budget Office, one of the few institutions in Washington that actually works the way it's supposed to. And he's boiled the deficit problem down to a single sentence. The American people want more in benefits, mainly for the elderly, than they're willing to send to Washington in taxes. And until we crack that nut, until somebody explains to people that we can't afford to do that forever, we're going to have a big deficit.
I'd love to get your take on the two presidential candidates and their plans for handling that. We'll do that after the break. I'm speaking with Wall Street Journal's David Wessel about Congress's annual showdown over the budget. His latest book is called Red Ink, Inside the High-Stakes Politics of the Federal Budget. It's published by Crown Business, and we'll be back with more after a break. Welcome back. I'm Elliot Forrest, in for Leonard Lopate. Today, my guest is David Wessel. The book is Red Ink, Inside the High-Stakes Politics of the Federal Budget. What do you make of the two presidential candidates' plans for lowering the deficit and fixing the budget?
Well, I'd really like to know what they are. One of the frustrations I have is that somehow we haven't managed to force the two candidates to say, okay, let's agree on this description of the problem, some neutral party's description of the problem, and can you tell us what you would do about it? Not, don't list me 13 small things that won't add up to something, but what would you really do to solve the problem so that we can compare what Mitt Romney's for and what Barack Obama's for? We can see a few things, though. President Obama believes that we cannot bring down the deficit and provide the services that he thinks the government needs to provide without raising taxes. He wants to raise them on people who make more than $250,000 a year. He says he can bring the deficit down without reaching deeper into the American middle class. I got my doubts about whether that's possible. Mitt Romney has really been, as David Brooks in the New York Times said the other day, running a policy-free campaign. He says he doesn't want to raise taxes. He does say he'd lower tax rates and raise as much money by doing away with a lot of deductions, loopholes, and credits. And he has embraced the budget put forward by Paul Ryan, the Wisconsin Republican who's chairman of the House Budget Committee, a rather austere budget that would change the federal government quite a bit. But it's not clear to me that Romney has really said, I'm going to propose that budget if I'm elected president. So the basics we know, Romney sees a smaller government with more defense spending, less spending on other things. Obama sees a bigger government, and he thinks we have to raise taxes. Romney says we don't.
In the past, people have said there's no differences between the party. Is this starting to be some kind of stark contrast as a perspective on the two candidates and how they would deal with the economic problems?
I think that's a really good point. I think that the notion that somehow there's no difference between the two parties, which when we were young was kind of a criticism that a lot of us had, has really faded. The upside of polarization is that we have a choice. The Republicans, particularly those in Congress, clearly stand for something quite different than most of the Democrats in Congress, and there's very little overlap.
You had said that the tax code is actually undermining the tax rates. Why don't you explain that?
Right. What happens is you set a tax rate. You say we're going to collect 28% of the income of this group of people. And then we say, but we're not going to count as income anything they spend on home mortgage interest or charity, or we're not going to count as income what they get in health insurance. And by the way, if they do this thing, buy this electric car, we're going to give them a tax break. And pretty soon you discover that you're taxing at a 28% rate, but the base has been shrunk. Every year, all the tax breaks in the corporate and individual income tax, put them all together, cost the government about $1.1 trillion, and the tax system brings in about $1.3 trillion. So you can see what the problem is here. The reason tax rates are so high is we don't apply them to so much of the income.
Besides the spending cuts and tax increases, is there another budget lever at our disposal that we're overlooking?
Well, there's not another budget lever. We would be better off if the economy were growing faster. If the economy is growing faster, A, people are better off, and that's what this is all about. After all, the point of budget policy is not to reduce the deficit or shrink the taxes as a share of GDP. The point of budget policy, like all government economic policy, ought to be to have a rising standard of living. If we could do things, and some people think tax reform, lowering the rates and doing away with loopholes, deductions, and credits is one way to do it. If we could do things that would make the economy grow faster, we'd be better off, and the economy would be throwing off more tax revenue that would bring down our deficit.
What role do you think the lack of compromise is playing? It just seems to me, and I am nowhere near an economist, but a little tax increase, some cuts, maybe both is the answer instead of these stark differences. If there was more compromise, would that work?
Well, you couldn't have much less compromise. So, yes. Look, when you look at these bipartisan budget commissions that now report with frequency, there was one by Republican Pete Domenici and Democrat Alice Rivlin. There was another one by Democrat Erskine Bowles and Republican Alan Simpson. They all come up with relatively similar lists of options that are weighted a little differently. It's not possible to solve this problem without compromise because Congress and indeed the American public are quite divided on this stuff. If compromise is seen as weakness, if Republicans refuse to compromise with Democrats and vice versa because they think that's bad politics or it challenges their own manhood or something, then we're going to be stuck with a very difficult situation. I don't see what changes that, and that's very alarming.
We talked about defense already, but what programs do you think offer the most opportunity for cutting the budget, say, except for defense?
Well, I think that there's a lot to be said about farm subsidies, which take a big chunk of money, about roughly $10 or $11 billion a year. It's kind of an old-fashioned idea that dates from an earlier era when we had a lot of people living on farms. Some of them go to people who are pretty well off. It's not very efficient. So that's one place that's ripe. But I think the big question is, how do we slow the growth of healthcare spending? In the early 80s, healthcare was less than 10% of the federal budget. Now it's a quarter, and it's on its way to a third. There's no simple, pain-free way to do this, but we spend more on healthcare than any other country. We don't have the healthiest people. Unless we find a way to control the growth of healthcare spending, we cannot control our deficit and our debt.
So what's your take on the Affordable Care Act? Is it making it better or worse?
I think the Affordable Care Act has done something incredibly important. One, it will, if it stands, reduce the number of people who are uninsured, and that's part of the problem. And secondly, it has given the federal government ownership of the healthcare cost problem like never before. What it has not done is put in place a credible way to slow healthcare costs. It's put a lot of little things in place that the architects hope will someday mature into a way to slow healthcare costs. But it's very interesting what's happening in Massachusetts now. Having done an Affordable Care Act-like thing under Mitt Romney, although he doesn't like to talk about it anymore, at least not favorably, they've now passed a second bit of legislation this week that limits the growth of healthcare spending. And I think until we find some way to do something like that, we're going to have a problem.
I'm Elliot Forrest in for Leonard Lopate. The guest is David Wessel, his book Red Ink, Inside the High-Stakes Politics of the Federal Budget. For the past 3 years, the government has been running a $1 trillion deficit, 10% of GDP. Pretty stark figures. Is that the worst it's ever been?
It's pretty bad. It's the worst it's been in recent history. One thing that's important to remember is the real problem is not today's deficit. I mean, the U.S. government has been fighting a recession, and it has been able to borrow incredible sums of money at interest rates lower than in your lifetime and my lifetime, and neither of us are young anymore, or at least I'm not.
You're way too kind.
The problem is tomorrow's deficit. When the economy recovers, and surely it will someday, we are still going to be running deficits that are bigger than we can manage. And the question is, what do we do now, not to reduce the deficit this year, because we're not having any trouble financing it. But what do we do so the trajectory is more sustainable, so we don't become the world's largest subprime borrower and find out one day that the Chinese want to put their money somewhere else?
I'm curious about that. You say the money's easy to get. How does that really work that we borrow money from China? Does somebody actually go over there and apply for a loan? Do they always say yes? Will they ever call in the note?
In the old days when Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were quasi-private companies, and they would actually have salesmen who would go to China and talk to the people who manage the government's large reserves and tell them, invest in our debt. You get a little more interest than you get when you lend to the U.S. Treasury, and don't worry, the U.S. Treasury stands behind it. As a result of that, the U.S. Treasury was pretty much forced to stand behind Fannie and Freddie's debt because so much of it was in the arms of the Chinese. Basically, what happens is the Chinese save a lot of money. They save much more than we do as a proportion of their income. It all ends up basically eventually in the hands of the Chinese banks, which are controlled by the Chinese government. And they come to the auctions that the federal government has every once in a while, and they give us money and we give them IOUs.
And is there some kind of risk that they'll just change their mind someday and call it all in?
Well, there is a risk that they'll change their mind, but you got to remember that they now have a pretty big stake in keeping us afloat. If they pull all their money out, if they could pull all their money out, that's one thing. If they pull a little bit of money out and spook the markets, that their holdings will go down. And also, they got a bit of a problem. No matter what they think about how crazy we are, every place else looks worse. We are the world's tallest midget.
Let's go back to the GDP. The Congressional Budget Office estimates that the rate that we talked about that is 10% now could be 100% of GDP in a decade, the national debt.
Now, you're mixing up two things here. 10% of GDP is our annual deficit. That's how much we spend more than we take in this year.
Okay.
The accumulated deficits or how much we borrow, the debt, is what CBO is talking about.
At 100%.
Right.
Is that likely to happen?
No. Something will happen before then, I'm pretty sure. Either the markets will rebel and global investors won't lend us the money, or we'll come to our senses. What CBO is trying to do is, I think, quite appropriate. They say, look, if you stay on this course, this is where you're going to end up. We think that you need to adjust your course. It's a little bit like those guys who used to fly the we used to see on TV flying the rockets when they came in. You know, they would fire the jets and they were coming from out of space and they would change the trajectory. So it's important to know where you're heading, but that doesn't it's not a prediction of where you're going to end up, because at least until now, we've always had some kind of correction that prevented us from getting to that point.
Does the CBO actually have some leverage on the budgetary process?
No. CBO is like your doctor. He's telling you what's going to happen if you don't exercise more, but he can't make you exercise. But it is very important, incredibly important, to kind of have an organization that is seen as honest and calling it as it sees it. And CBO has been protected by both Democrats and Republicans because they recognize in such a polarized atmosphere where every politician says things that are different from what every other politician says, and you quite never quite know who's telling the truth, it's important to have some arbiter. It's very interesting to me that the British didn't have this, and they recently set one up. So, as you can tell, I'm a pretty big fan of CBO. They don't get everything right, of course. They're human beings. But so far, their integrity has been intact, and they are given credit for calling it as they see it.
Are people, including the White House, actually taking into account the CBO's projections?
Yes, they have to. The White House knows that one of the reasons CBO exists is because the White House over the years has lost its credibility. And when Congress actually passes laws and they have to decide how much they'll cost or how much they'll save, they rely on CBO estimates. So the White House makes its own estimates, but they know that if they're wildly different than CBO's, we in the press and the members of Congress will assume that the White House cooked the books and CBO is right.
One of the problems you talk about is the way people sort of view facts, and they see facts as political or not political. What do you mean by that?
What I mean is that we seem to be unable to distinguish between facts and choices. The fact is that we are not raising enough money to cover our expenses. The fact is that the tax burden in the United States on most people, the federal tax burden, has come down. The fact is that we're spending more and more every year on health care, and we probably can't keep that up. The choices are, what do we do about it? How best to restrain health care spending? Do we give everybody a voucher? Do we put everybody in a government-run plan? And so I think that the problem is that people start with their choices and then they select a set of facts that defend their point of view, and that's completely confused people, and that's unfortunate. I think the role of journalists is to say, look, there are differences between Republicans and Democrats, and these are what the differences are. But there are some things that we can't argue about. The earth is not flat.
I wonder how much this political season makes the problem even worse. It just doesn't seem like the truth is being told, and it's an extended period of time, more than a year now, of jockeying more than getting to the problem.
I agree with you. And it's not this campaign isn't all that different than other campaigns. You know, I kind of sometimes think, so I would not have wanted Ross Perot to be president. I don't think most Americans thought Ross Perot would have made a good president. But he sure as heck was a constructive force in that campaign, because he kind of came at the two camps and said, you guys don't make sense, you know. Look under the hood and tell me what you see. At the moment, there's no force like that that's holding their feet to the fire. And I'm a little self-critical of the press in general. I mean, if I read one more story about some web ad that didn't even run in very many communities where Mitt Romney says this and Barack Obama says that, and pretty soon it's like dueling web ad designers as if that's what to decide the fate of the country.
Do you think congressmen and women are also unaware of the facts? Who are you actually aiming your book at?
Well, I'm not aiming my book at members of Congress. I'm aiming my book at the voters and people who know that the budget and the deficit are important but have never found the time to read to the end of any Wall Street Journal story on the subject. I want them to see that there are big building blocks. You only need to understand them. Some members of Congress get this. A lot don't. It's unfortunate that some of the people we've elected to Congress have campaigned for office on a promise to be angrier than their constituents. And once in office, they've delivered on that promise. But it doesn't really give you much guidance for how do I craft a budget. It's not true of all of them. I think all of us who cover Washington know the difference between smart congressmen who may have different points of view and people who are idiots. The thing that worries me the most is some of the people who seem to be the smartest and the most thoughtful are the ones who are saying, this institution is so dysfunctional, I'm not going to run for reelection. That's a really troubling sign.
Give us a little history in the time we have left of capital gains. I think people would be surprised by this.
Well, capital gains are the profits you make from the share of selling a stock or something. Right now, we give a much lower tax rate on capital gains. But Ronald Reagan, in 1986, signed the Tax Reform Act of 1986, which made the tax rate on ordinary income, wages, and capital gains identical. And it's only since then that we've widened it again. There's a big argument about that. That is one difference between Romney and Obama. Romney would keep it low. Obama would raise it. And there's a huge academic debate about whether this is a good idea or not for the health of the economy.
What do you make of the new bipartisan National Committee for Fiscal Reform?
Look, I think all these bipartisan committees are trying to do the right thing, which is lay before the American people a set of options so they can see that this is doable. But ultimately, it's going to require some political resolve from our elected leaderships to say, okay, we like flavor A, we like flavor B, we don't like flavor C. Here's a package that we're going to vote for. So far, that hasn't happened yet.
What would be the first couple of steps in fixing all this red ink?
I think we have to make a decision about what do we want from government, and then do we have to raise taxes? I think it's likely we'll raise taxes. So what's the best way to do that without harming the economy? How do we decide? How do we control health care costs, and what do we do about the size of the defense budget? If you solve all those problems, everything else is relatively small more.
Fascinating book. Great stuff. Always much more to be learned. I've been speaking with the Wall Street Journal's David Wessel about Congress's annual showdown over the budget and where all that money, once it's appropriated, actually goes. His latest book is called Red Ink, Inside the High-Stakes Politics of the Federal Budget. It's published by Crown Business. David, thanks for coming in today.
You're welcome.